Hello, I'm Ivan Berg, and this is my story. Part 19, The Top Gear Years, and BBC Online. I'm jumping 9 years in this episode, and we'll pick up on the years from 1984 to 1993 as soon as I have written them up. This episode was written separately to explain my involvement in the beginnings of TopGear.com and BBC Online, and was prompted in response to a request from someone who said he was from the National Computer Museum. In May 1993, I was awarded a contract by Redwood Publishing, acting in partnership with BBC Enterprises, to set up a database of new car facts and figures to be used as the back section of a new BBC Top Gear magazine, which was to be launched the following October. Why me? Well, I had just published a Guinness publishing title called The Guinness World Car Record, otherwise known as Berg's Bible, that listed the very full specifications of 5,000 cars, dating from the end of the 19th century to March 1992, together with over 1,000 computer-generated lists, including fastest, heaviest, lightest, most accelerative and most economical cars. My wife Inga and I used our inherited skills from the computer software company we owned and ran for 10 years, up until 1990 when it went bust. We collected the car data from One Make Car Clubs and Auto Car Magazine road tests. I read out the data and Inga keyed it into the database. It was laborious and took us over a year. I learned the database query language and was able to devise programs to extract the data in a multitude of ways. Example, best Alfa Romeo 0 to 60 time, that is up to 1990, answer 6.2 seconds. 1985 GTV Callaway Quin Turbo 122. At the time, these skills, researching, setting up a database, entering and extracting data, made us unique in the world of motoring journalism. The contract with Redwood was for 12 months, by which time it was assumed that the magazine's journalists would have been trained up to maintain and run the Top Gear new car database. Of course, none of the journalists wanted anything to do with it, apart from asking me to provide facts for road tests. The 12-month contract had an annual rollover clause and was rolled over annually for the next 17 years. Coincidentally, our son Nick, having cut his motoring journalism teeth on Auto Express magazine, also joined the new Top Gear magazine in August. We worked from home. Inga did the boring job of inputting the new car data, and I had the more public job of obtaining it from the car makers. We ran the computer once a month, 2 weeks before publication, saving the file to a floppy disk that I delivered by hand to the Redwood offices in Camden. I was quickly christened Data Dad, the data editor. I think it was Chris Maylard, managing editor, who came up with it. Chris was one of the trio of enfants terribles at the top of the mag that consisted of editor Kevin Blick, managing editor Chris Maylard, and art director Marcel Ashby. I say enfant terrible because all three took great pride in refusing to take part in or kowtow to BBC corporatism or anything that smacked of political correctness. It was this that gave the new magazine its very successful Top Gear ethos. That and its association with the increasingly popular BBC Two Top Gear programme, and in particular presenter and magazine columnist Jeremy Clarkson. Redwood chairman Mike Potter asked me if it was possible to develop a new car buyer's reader service using the database. The result was Car Chase, a programme that produced a list of cars that met particular criteria, such as price, air conditioning, fuel consumption, 0 to 60 miles an hour time, power steering, or even sunroofs. This was introduced with the very first issue of BBC Top Gear magazine and was swiftly popular. I became a motoring agony uncle, answering readers' often very silly questions to Dear Data Dad, with half a dozen or so paragraphs illustrated with cartoons dotted around the back section data pages of the magazine. This alternated with dotty data, paragraphs of trivial info extracted from both the Guinness and Top Gear databases. Very useful for pub quiz organisers. I even managed to persuade Kevin and Top Gear publisher Stuart Snaith to let me revive my audio production skills and record supercar engine noises with commentary by me for sale on cassette. Marcel came up with the great title of Full Metal Racket. We sold a few thousand copies and even recorded Full Metal Racket 2 at the Goodwood Festival of Speed. This led to an embarrassing interview on breakfast TV when I couldn't identify any of the engine noises played back to me. The 11th of May 1994 was the BBC's first foray on the new World Wide Web with BBC Education's Networking Club, a non-profit subscription service that gave members access to a bulletin board for sharing information and real-time conversation. It was an unfunded shoestring operation running in spare time by Brandon Butterworth, BBC principal technologist, and Martin Freeth, and a couple of other technical colleagues. I recall a fascinating meeting and walking away with my head reeling with possibilities. Although I don't think they had a clue what I was talking about, I persuaded Kevin and Stuart to let me begin work on a Top Gear magazine website. Initially, I handed pages of copy over to one of Martin's enthusiastic young colleagues and discussed how I thought the web pages should look. I found this to be time-consuming and frustrating, and when I discovered how the pages were coded in HTML, the language of the World Wide Web used to construct websites, I decided to have a go myself. This is not as stupid as it sounds, as I was already familiar with the basic computer language from my 10 years in the computer software business and the query language of the car database. In the early version of HTML, the language was simple and there were actually fewer commands to learn. So, in November 1994, the Top Gear magazine website was launched. As far as we knew, it was the first car magazine website in the world, and also the first proper website under a BBC banner. For the next couple of years, I updated the site every month, mainly promoting the current issue of the magazine. Over time, it grew to become more sophisticated. It had a fully interactive version of Car Chase, multimedia with extracts from Full Metal Racket and even tiny video clips. And for the 1995 Formula One motor racing season, another first. Marcel and Chris asked me if I could devise an interactive fantasy Formula One game to run on the website, with promotion in the magazine for every race. This ran for the 1995 season, becoming international in 1996, with over 25,000 players. The site rapidly gained a reputation for innovation and was in Microsoft's top 10 lists of ultimate websites in 1996. It was also increasingly popular, with almost 500,000 page views a week. And in 1996, that was a heck of a lot. I registered TopGear.com on October the 26th, 1995. Up until then, we were using the BBC network server. I recall Kevin being horrified when I put up a magazine masthead page, complete with everyone's email address. "Take it down," he said. "We'll be inundated with emails." And talking of Microsoft, there was almost a joint venture project between Top Gear magazine and the software giant in 1996. Adam Waddell, then magazine's special projects manager, grabbed me in some excitement and asked me to accompany him to a meeting at the Microsoft UK headquarters, as he was a bit bemused by technology and wanted me on the side. I remember seeing Adam sitting silently during the meeting, making agreeing noises and nodding from time to time as ideas were batted around between me and the four Microsoft execs. I've forgotten the detail of what was discussed. I think the thrust of the meeting was about a joint venture with cars on the internet. But I walked away with a boot full of Microsoft software and Adam saying, "What was all that about?" as we left. Nothing came of it, as BBC Worldwide was already negotiating with the UK IT company ICL. Inga and I suspected something was afoot when we were visited by two clean-cut young men wearing smart suits and company ties, carrying identical black briefcases, from consultants McKinsey and Company. They spent most of the day looking at my screen and questioning me about how I saw the future development of the internet and BBC websites. I handed them copies of a set of notes I had made for Top Gear publisher Stuart Snaith about the future of publishing on the internet and its probable impact on paper publishers, which he used in a speech he made at the 1995 Periodical Publishers Association conference. Needless to say, when I eventually saw a copy of the McKinsey report, it was almost word for word the notes I had made for Stuart. So the parable about consultants borrowing your watch to tell you what time it is and then walking off with it rang true. As we suspected, all the Top Gear web activity had eventually caught the interest of both the rebranded BBC Worldwide and the BBC itself. The McKinsey visit was a precursor to a deal between the BBC and computer giant ICL. I became a sort of web guru, as I was the only one in the organisation who was actually running a successful website. A BBC online committee was set up. Roles were allocated. As I recall, there were six of us, sometimes more when management wished to sit in. Charts were presented, organisational charts, ways and means memorandums, personnel needs, outsourcing of HTML coding, I demonstrated the Top Gear website many times, projecting it onto a screen in the one meeting room so equipped at the BBC Worldwide White City Woodlands offices and taking lots of questions. Lots and lots of questions. I remember editorial director Nick Brett taking an interest and organising private VIP demonstrations. One I remember particularly was to the visiting publisher of a German car magazine who cheekily asked if he could have a copy of the HTML code. Nick said yes. There were meetings to set the agenda of the next meeting and follow-up meetings to discuss what was said at the previous meeting. It was despairing, but it was the BBC way. I was reminded of it in March 2014 with the broadcasting of the satirical series W1A. And then, in 1996, it must have been around August, something actually happened. And it was nothing at all to do with all the meetings in the Woodlands offices. BBC News was about to sabotage the venture by going it alone, reneging on a 50 million joint venture deal with ICL and ignoring the BBC politics that threatened to delay or even bring the whole shebang to a shuddering halt. I was contacted by a BBC News reporter called Mike Smart. Because of his well-known interest in technology and the World Wide Web, he was asked by his boss, head of news, Tony Hall, now Lord Hall of Birkenhead, ex-BBC Director General, to research and then produce a video to be shown to the then Director General, John Burt, and top BBC executives. The tape had to demonstrate the potential of BBC Online in as powerful a way as possible. And it took hardly any time at all. Mike and I had a couple of very productive meetings. We went through the now well-thumbed Snaith notes. Mike scripted the first half, demonstrating the look and feel of a futuristic BBC News online website, and I showed how the Top Gear magazine website might look in the future, with video road tests and then with something that was already online, Fantasy Formula One. I think I can do no better than quote the text introduction to the video that I wrote when I put it up on YouTube in 2013, with the permission of the BBC, in case you ask. A long, long time ago, in 1996, when BBC Top Gear magazine and BBC News were doing pioneering stuff on the new World Wide Web, Top Gear webmaster Ivan Berg and BBC newsman Mike Smart were commissioned by the then head of BBC News, Tony Hall, to put together a futuristic video for the then Director General John Burt and his top executives to show what a potential BBC website called BBC Online might look like. The video was scripted and put together in a BBC VTR suite using the video technology available at the time and voiced by Mike Smart, to mimic the look and feel of a future BBC Online website. The BBC's top brass were convinced. Money and resources were made available, and the BBC went digital, big time. Mike went on with project director Bob Edgington to lead the team that created and ran the multi-award-winning BBC News Online website, getting himself an OBE in the process. Our forecast turned out to be remarkably accurate, with one exception. We had little idea of how important pages of text and still pictures would become, with the news features and analysis by BBC editors, correspondents and reporters that today make up an important part of BBC News Online. Giving BBC News equal credit for pioneering was political. In fact, Top Gear magazine was well ahead, with a website that was up and running from November 1994, whereas BBC News had just the one site for the 1995 budget and was not online with news until December 1997. In the several histories of BBC Online that have been written, not a word of credit has been given to Top Gear magazine and the foresight of Kevin Blick, Stuart Snaith, Chris Maylard, Marcel Ashby, or me.